Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I post it on our social media, pieville.net, and also at my daily digest from the white point of view at kirksvilletoday.com. Today we're going to do chapter 3 out of The Crucifixion of Russia, Columbus Falco's translation of Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, A History of the Russians and the Jews. Chapter 3, it'll be a little shorter than the other ones. Chapter 3, Under the Reign of Nicholas I, and as we know, we've been hearing about Jews acting like scum, the Derzhavin Memorandum that was a noble or high-end man sort of going through the country and recording what Jews were actually doing and the effect they were having on the serfs, the peasants, the basic Russians, and recommendations for reform, and how he was essentially cashier. The Jews tried to bribe and were even prepared to assassinate him if they couldn't go on selling liquor and practicing usury and the rest of the stuff we know they do. And the attempts to reform Jews into useful people, productive people, solid characters by turning them to farming. Nah, they just took whatever loans and benefits they could get, any kind of oxen or any kind of seed, and they sold it, and they just didn't want to become farmers, and that has always been the case with them. So chapter 3, Under the Reign of Nicholas I. Nicholas I was energetically opposed to Russian Jewry. Well, that's refreshing. Energetically opposed to Russian Jewry. Sources say that half of all official acts taken against Jews between the time of Alexei Mikhailovich to the death of Alexander II were initiated, who we heard about last time, Alexander I, were initiated by Tsar Nikolai. So Nicholas I was very anti-Jew. In Jewish historiography, the cruel and firm character of the monarch is consistently confirmed. However, the personal intervention of Nicholas I was not always negative for the Jews. One instance is a case which was held over from the reign of Alexander I, the Veliz Affair, V-E-L-I-Z-H. Local Jews were accused of the ritual murder of a Christian boy, says the Jewish Encyclopedia. There is no doubt that the acquittal of the accused Jews was largely due to the sovereign's determination to seek the truth, in spite of opposition from people whom he trusted. In another well-known case involving the prosecution of Jews, the Mstislavl riot, Mstislavl, the emperor willingly sought out the truth. Although in a moment of anger he imposed punishment on the local Jewish population, he did not refuse to recognize his mistakes. After the acquittal on the Veliz case, Nicholas wrote to the local police and judiciary, making it clear that, quote, other solutions cannot follow, essentially ordering that there was to be no violence directed or allowed against the Jewish population. He added his inner conviction that ritual murder did take place, but this were the work of, it doesn't say A, or whether he means generally or that specific one that the dispute was over, but in general, at least, he believes that Jewish ritual murder does take place, but this were the work of, quote, Jews of some fanatical sect, i.e. some subset. Unfortunately, among us, Christians, there are sometimes sects no less terrible and incomprehensible. We're just as bad. And see how they define themselves as Christian. That's their opposition to Jews. The Jews are Jews and we're Christians. They're not opposing them from a racial point of view, so they are opposing them weakly and incorrectly and ultimately self-defeatingly, ineffectively. In fact, what they're doing is defending the Jews while thinking they're defending themselves. And that's what happens when you're a Christian. If you try to come at Jews from the religious direction, you're defending them while undermining yourself, usually without realizing it. That's where helpful people like me come in. and you listening who can spread the actual truth. Nicholas I and many of his entourage continued to believe that some groups of Jews practiced ritual murder, says Solzhenitsyn. This case and others confirm the existing prejudice that the Jewish faith is a danger to the Christian population. Well, it's not a faith, it's just Jews are a danger to whites, to all other non-Jews. Nicholas saw a danger that the Jews would convert Christians to Judaism. Well, that's interesting. So we know Jews don't proselytize normally and are actually against converts. Even they take some, but they're still biased against them for a very long time. In 1823, the Interior Minister reported on the widely disseminated heresy of Judaizers, capital J, in Russia. The Interior Minister, 1823, reported on the widely disseminated heresy of Judaizers in Russia. See chapter 1, we've heard about that. Legal measures were taken against quasi-Jewish sects, and many of these formally returned to the Orthodox Church, although there was heavy suspicion that they continued secretly to observe Jewish rituals. So either end of the continent, whether you're in Spain with the Muranos or here with these Judaizing Jews, even if they pretend to convert to Orthodox or Catholicism, they still retain their Jewish ways, their Jewish thinking, and their Jewish behavior, suggesting that it is in fact a racial trait. It doesn't go away by dripping water on them or by them saying something when they're under pressure to convert or stop doing something else. There was heavy suspicion that they continued secretly to observe Jewish rituals. All this led to a great deal of legislation regarding Jews in the era of Nicholas I, much of it with a distinctly religious tinge. His own religious belief left its mark on the decisions and actions of Nicholas I with respect to the Jews, such as his insistence on banning Jews' use of Christian servants, in particular nurses, because, quote, the service of the Jews insults and weakens the Christian faith in women. In spite of repeated bans, these orders were difficult to enforce and never carried out entirely, which is a constant theme in this book, that even in the cases they make laws or stipulations against Jews, they're never fulfilled, they're never carried out, they're ignored. They're evaded or they're simply ignored. Conscription of Jews. The first measure was to equate Jews with the Russian population in bearing the burdens of the state, namely to apply the conscription laws, the draft laws, to young Jewish men, something which had never before been attempted. So he's the first one to say, hey, look, you know, if you're going to be equal citizens, you have to be drafted the same way everyone else is. Prior to this, Jews had instead been taxed for the privilege of not serving their country. At this point in history, draftees in Imperial Russia were inducted between the ages of 12 and 25, and for no less than 25 years. The underlying purpose of the new conscription laws was to reduce the number of Jews who were not engaged in productive labor, but it was also believed that isolating a recruit from a wholly Jewish environment and breaking the iron spiritual hand of rabbis would greatly facilitate adaptation to the nationwide order of life. Gradually, greater numbers of Jews were called to the colors at earlier ages. So we shift on to page 80. The imperial decree on Jewish conscription met with massive resistance and evasion. There was much internal opposition from within the government itself, and various departments were slow to implement the order. The Council of Ministers debated as to whether it was ethical to take such a measure to, quote, to limit the multitude of Jews, unquote, and recognize the impropriety of taking people for money, as Finance Minister E.F. Kankrin wrote. The Kagalam, or Kahals, made every possible effort to protect the Jewish population from impending conscription or somehow to delay it. Exasperated by the foot-dragging, Nicholas ordered the relevant authorities to submit a final report as soon as possible, but the Kahal seemed to have exerted every possible influence to slow the process down or tie it up with bureaucratic red tape. Some military officers were also opposed to the move, and somehow the report was never filed. So even the guy who's running the whole country can't get anything done if he goes against what the Jews want. In Russia in the 1820s, just like USA today, Yuhessa, I guess that's Yehuda Hesse, concludes, that mysterious episode hardly occurred without the participation of the Kahal. So the Kahal is the Jewish organization within the state is directing the Jews and organizing them in their non-compliance. Nicholas, exasperated, introduced conscription for the Jews on his own in 1827. There were loopholes in the new law. It completely exempted merchants of all guilds, residents of agricultural colonies, guild masters, mechanics in factories, rabbis, and all Jews who had secondary or higher education. This had the effect of Jews rushing frantically to enter themselves or their sons into the exempted occupations or to obtain fraudulent documentation that they had done so. One common trick was to hire a Christian substitute to report for induction. At one stage, the going rate for a Gentile recruit to replace a Jewish one was 500 rubles. In any event, records show that on average in most years, only 10 conscripts per 1,000, not 100, per 1,000, only 10 out of 1,000 Jew males were served with call-up notices. So again, effectively, Jews have managed to neutralize legislation that they don't like, even if it comes from the very top of a country. So Jews simply don't follow any rules but their own is a constant theme throughout all Jew history. And it defines Jew-Goy interaction. They hate us, so obviously they're not going to follow any law that we put down, even in our own lands. So it leads to the question, why are they in our lands? Why do we allow them among us? And there's no good answer to that. The Jews protested that the bulk of conscription came down on the back of the Jewish poor. In 1829, Nicholas I attempted to take in an excess of Jewish recruits to cover unpaid back taxes from the Jewish community. This measure was soon halted due to abuse on the part of both excessively zealous local authorities and Jews who moved heaven and earth to evade the draft. Hesse wrote of this period that it was an, quote, abnormality, unquote, in Russian legislation, and in Russia in general there was a tendency to impose greater obligations on the Jews than on another subject due to their alien nature. Of course, that's a Jew writing that. I assume Hesse is a Jew. Nicholas I remained determined to convert Jews into ordinary Russian citizens. One such project was the creation of cantonments, quote-unquote, like Switzerland, similar to those created by Peter the Great in the 18th century for the sons of soldiers serving those long 25-year hitches. Now I'm wrong. Cantons isn't cantonments are not the same. A kind of school for military training military children and orphans for later service with the army. So he set up some cantonments for military training. The revival of this traditional institution was thought by bureaucrats of the time to be quite suitable for Jewish boys, desirable because it would create early and long separation from their Jewish environment. With this in view, the 1827 decree granted the Jewish community, at its discretion, the right to provide a minor male child not younger than 12 years old in place of a single adult recruit. The New Jewish Encyclopedia refers to this measure as a, quote, most heavy blow. This was not exactly conscription as such, since the Russian army did not accept 12-year-old soldiers, but it gave the government a chance to remove at least a few young Jews from the shtetl, get them out of the yeshivas, place them in a secular environment in the cantonments, and give them a proper education in some kind of physical and beneficial trade. At the age of 18, they would enter the regular army and exercise these trades. Local kahals appear to have had, at least on some occasions, used this provision to fob the army off with a 12-year-old son of a poor family instead of a more economically or socially desirable young man, recompensing the new recruit's family monetarily for the loss of their son. So they probably shifted some of their worse in there, maybe their charity cases or something. According to statistics from the military archives of the general staff accounts, in 1847 to 1854, the years most young Jews were sent to cantonments, 1847 to 1854, there's a missing hyphen or something, they accounted for an average of 2.4% from all the cantonments in Russia. That is, their share does not exceed the proportionate share of the Jewish population of the country, even according to the low Kagalom data for the then census. So, at most, they're proportionate to their share of the population, but probably a lot lower, actually. It should be said that conditions in the Imperial Army were not quite as grim as they may sound today. Soldiers were allowed to marry and live with their families in their place of garrison, and at the end of their 25 years of service, could be given land in agricultural colonies or legal residence in towns and cities to practice a trade. Jews, however, were conditioned to a sedentary life in the more desirable cities and provinces of the empire. Jewish soldiers found it difficult to maintain their faith, keep the Sabbath, adhere to the kosher dietary laws, and so on. Jewish youngsters in the cantonment schools found it still more difficult to remain, quote, good Jews, unquote, in the face of deliberate state pressure to secularize and adapt themselves to the modern world. One of the first things they were taught was to read and write in Cyrillic Russian, thus giving them intellectual access to the world outside the shtetl. It is difficult to determine how effective the cantonments were in secularizing or converting Jewish pupils. Jewish literature and oral tradition from the period are full of horror stories of abuse and coerced conversion, Jewish children drowned in rivers if they refused to become Christians, and so on, i.e. lying. 800 of them at one go were drowned, according to legend, in a botched attempt at mass baptism. And, of course, that's purely fanciful. We know the Jews are well known for lying about that type of stuff. At this distance in time, it is hard to ascertain the degree of truth in these allegations, especially given the historical propensity of the Jewish people to embellish, I wouldn't say embellish, I'd simply say make up out of whole cloth, the undoubted reality of their suffering down through the centuries. It is certain that Nicholas I and his government proceeded with the deliberate policy of separating the Jewish students in the military cantonment schools from their heritage and dragging them into the modern world willy-nilly. However, stories of hundreds of Jewish children drowned in rivers by Tsarist bureaucrats may probably be disregarded. Obviously, some of the students in the cantonments must have converted in order to obtain the benefits of full participation in Russian society, and it was later to their advantage to exaggerate in the eyes of the tribe the degree of force and coercion to which they were subjected. Also, as took place in Spain and elsewhere down through the centuries, many of the conversions were false conversions of convenience, and those involved continued to practice Judaism in secret. After a Belarusian famine in 1822, Alexander I had sent inspectors to the Pale, and they essentially returned with the same conclusions that Derzhavin made a quarter of a century before. In 1823, the Tsar established a Jewish committee consisting of four ministers to address yet again the issue on what to do with the Jews and how to transform them into useful and productive citizens of the Russian state, living in at least some semblance of peace and harmony with their Christian neighbors. We heard about this before. In 1825, this Jewish committee of ministers was replaced by a director's committee, the fifth in a row, consisting of directors of departments, which studied and largely evaded the problem for another 8 years. Nicholas I was too impatient to await this committee's final report, and so he unilaterally introduced Jewish conscription as described above. Once again, the Tsar decreed a 3-year period for the expulsion of the Jews from the villages of the western provinces to at least try and get them away from the border areas, as well as a ban on selling wine and liquor. Later, he prohibited actual ownership or leasing of taverns and inns by Jews, but as was the case with all such measures, enforcement was spotty at best. In 1827, Nicholas introduced what amounted to a national liquor licensing system throughout the empire. 1827, national liquor licensing. Along with an attempt to turn many taverns throughout the empire into government postal stations and lease them out to Christians. But without the Jews, there were not enough bidders. What inevitably occurred was that official licenses for the sale of alcohol and tavern and inn leases fell into the hands of Jews through various acts of chicanery or simple outright bribery of local officials. State efforts to compel Jews to perform productive physical labor failed time and again. Another prominent Jewish economic activity in Imperial Russian history was the hated practice of tax farming. In addition to the high level of income throughout both legitimate and corrupt taxation, tax farmers under the czars enjoyed full rights of residence and freedom of movement, and lived freely in the capital and other cities outside the Pale. Some tax farmers became prominent Jewish public figures such as Feigin, F-E-I-G-I-N, and Litman Evzel Gunzberg, who went on to found a St. Petersburg banking house, the largest in Russia, G-U-N-Z-B-U-R-G, Gunzberg, the largest banking house in Russia in St. Petersburg, and later took part in the replacement or in the placement of Russian and foreign governmental loans. In 1826, Nicholas I ordered the eviction back to the Pale of Settlement of Jewish distillers and tavern keepers who had infiltrated into Great Russia, and in an attempt to replace them, the state-owned and state-operated liquor industry was born, but with little success as far as banning Jews went. Jews infiltrated the state distilleries, such as those in Irkutsk. Throughout his reign, the autocratic power of Nicholas I never succeeded in the kind of complete transformation of Jewish life and forced assimilation of the Jewish people he envisioned. So yet another guy tries and fails to reform Jews rather than accepting they are what they are. And what you need to do is get them out of your country underground, where it's safe for us. So it was with Jewish farming. The Charter of Conscription and Military Service for Jews in 1827 specifically exempted Jews who were members of governmental agricultural colonies from the military service for a period of 50 years. This understandably led to at least a brief return of Jewish men to those colonies from their authorized and unauthorized absences until other ways were found around the law and they were able to return to the cities in their multifarious non-manual labor trades. By 1829, more detailed rules had been developed for Jewish farmers involving rental to burghers or Christian citizens, payment of all debts, and permitting absences of draft-age men from the farm of up to 3 months. V.N. Nikitin admits that when comparing Jewish farmers' rights and benefits to those enjoyed by other tax-paying classes, it cannot be denied that the government favored the Jews. They refuse to comply with laws, but they're always treated favorably apart from those laws. So it's ridiculous. No duties, no responsibilities, all privileges. So from 1829 to 1833, many Jews became zealous farmers, at least on paper. After the Turkish War of 1829, Jewish settlers, like all the colonists, begged the Tsar to forgive all arrears and respected taxes due to the burden they bore in feeding the troops. But according to reports of the Trusteeship Committee, a poor harvest in 1833 made it impossible to hold Jews in the colonies. According to the committee, many Jews simply did not want to practice rural employment. Jews who were supposed to be farming refused to sow anything, or very little. They sold cattle in order to wander, to beg, and not pay taxes. In 1834, they sold bread and cattle given to them by the government and the local authorities, owing to the difficulties in supervision, were unable to prevent, quote, crafty twists, unquote, by settlers. Crop failures among Jews occurred more frequently than among other villagers because, in addition to sowing few crops, they worked the land randomly and out of season. One would think, says Solzhenitsyn, that the 30-year-old experience of attempted Jewish arable farming would have been enough for the Russian government to give up the project and save the immense amount of money being wasted, but Tsar Nicholas pressed on. He strongly believed in the beneficial effect of a secularized education for Jewish children to wean them away from the grip of the rabbis and to overcome the Jewish alienation from the general population, which he saw as the main danger. But the alienation is, if you're allowing them to practice Judaism at all, if they have any contact with rabbis, they're being taught to hate non-Jews. And I believe they instinctively hate non-Jews because I've observed that in them. Like I said, to me, I always watched Jews and I had no particular feeling about them one way or another. I mean, I learned quickly they're all leftist. They're always advocating stuff that's destructive. They're always advocating special privileges. I noticed that in high school. I noticed that people suck up to them. And I noticed that the way they interact with others, it's extremely clear they see non-Jews as them, Jews as us, and they're hostile. They're hostile to such an extent, they always seem to me like, you know, those wasps, like, say, settled in a Coke can and their feelers twitching. I've used this before, but that Jews always seem to have a pair of those invisibly. You could just see them twitching with the loathing they have for non-Jews. It's quite visible on them, on many of them. I mean, they may try to disguise it, but very, very close to the surface in a huge percentage of Jews is just this utter contempt for non-Jews. I don't think anyone can dispute that. Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, Ghislaine. I'm not going to stop calling her Ghislaine. I know that's not the correct pronunciation. I also don't care. Now, so they're wasting all this money, giving Jews special privileges, trying to turn them into farmers. The Jews are just repeatedly showing they're not going to do it. In 1831, Tsar Nicholas memorandized the Directors' Committee that, quote, among the measures that could improve the situation of the Jews, it is necessary to pay attention to the correction of their training institutions and to prohibition early marriage. Quote, clearly the Tsar intended to control and reduce their numbers. In 1840, yet another of these interminable committees stated as their primary objective to act on the moral education of a new generation of Jews and an establishment of Jewish schools in the spirit, not the current Talmudic doctrine. Close quote. In 1835, His Majesty approved the regulations of the Jews, the work of Directors' Committee. Jewish agriculture was not only retained as the centerpiece of government Jewish policy, but extended. Any Jew was now permitted to go into farming, and having done so, any arrears and taxes he might have would be erased. So they're bending over backward to get these Jews to become farmers. Jews were now allowed to not only receive state-owned land, but to buy, sell, and rent land within the Pale of Settlement. Embracing the agricultural life earned a Jew exemption from poll tax. Jews turning into farmers were exempt from the poll tax for 25 years, with 10 years exemption county taxes and 50 years from conscription. Yet Jews remained an infinitesimal proportion of the nation's farmers. The majority of Jews continued to avoid agriculture or any manual labor like the plague. It is true that many Jews were often artisans, tailors, shoemakers, watchmakers, jewelers, anything involving remaining indoors all day. The Jewish national aversion to being outdoors, whenever it can be avoided, becomes even more pronounced. The Jewish national aversion to being outdoors. The pre-revolutionary Jewish Encyclopedia says that the Jews began to contribute to the development of large-scale industry in the form of finance, and many of them followed Jewish development in Western countries and made money itself their stock in trade and profession. Jews were bankers and state tax farmers, moneylenders and money changers. Even a great tax farmer and financier such as Shinkarev demanded and personally collected all payments from his tenants and debtors in cash. By the 1840s, there was a great development of the sugar industry in the southwest regions of Russia. Jewish capitalists and landlords first invested in and subsidized sugar mills, and then took over their management, and then built their own factories. In Ukraine and New Russia arose powerful sugar kings, for example, Lazar and Lev Brodsky. Most Jewish sugar kings began their careers as tavern owners and wine sellers in the Pale. A similar pattern was visible in the textile milling industry. Nicholas I saw himself as an autocrat on the model of Peter the Great, authoritatively determined to mold the entirety of the Russian state and society to his liking, and like all autocrats, he reduced the complexity of the human experience to simple, clearly understandable issues and obstacles to be overcome. And there you get a little of Solzhenitsyn's philosophy. The 1840 Government Committee on the Perpetual Jewish Problem floated a proposal on how to overcome the religious and national alienation of the Jews, with some input from prominent tribesmen such as Levinson, Feigen, and Jizianovsky. The government attempted to, quote, explore the root of the Jews' persistent alienation from the common civil life and the absence among them of useful labor and the proliferation of the harmful class of petty industry, accompanied by all sorts of tricks and deceptions. This idleness among many Jews was attributed to their, quote, inveterate habits, unquote. Nicholas believed that the Jewish mass could indeed find productive occupation, but that they rejected some types of labor due to their traditions. Page 88 we are. Minister Count Kiselyov suggested to the emperor a measure of Jewish classifications into two categories. In the first category, those who had settled and established wealth and property, the second to include all those who did not. Jews in the second category were to be given a 5-year period in order to become guild craftsmen or farmers. After 5 years, those who do not comply and yet remained in the state would be considered useless and applied to special military and labor service. They would be conscripted at age 20 at 3 times the normal Jewish intake, not for the usual 25 years of military service, but only for 10 years, and were to use that 10 years to learn a productive craft or trade, which they would practice on discharge, that is, to give them compulsory job training. This project was approved by Nicholas I. The term, quote, useless Jews, unquote, was replaced by, quote, those with no productive work, euphemism. Other measures also went forward, such as laws for the destruction and disbandment of the Kahal in all its forms, the establishment of government-sanctioned provincial rabbis, mandatory secular secondary education for Jews in an attempt to dismantle the yeshiva system, more settlement of Jews on state-owned land with plows thrust into their hands, and finally a ban on the wearing of traditional Jewish dress. These laws of various kinds were in effect in Russia for almost a third of a century, and none of them worked. Assimilate them, discriminate against them, give them privileges, none of it is changing their nature. The 1840 regulations provided a 5-year period of pre-employment selection, and through assorted bureaucratic misadventure, which may or may not have arisen from massive bribes by the Jews to various Tsarist functionaries, the measure itself was only officially promulgated in 1846, so that the analysis phase was to be completed in January 1852. In 1843, arguing against the, quote, parsing, unquote, of the Jews, the Governor General of New Russia, M. Vorontsov, wrote that the occupation of the, quote, numerous class of small traders and middlemen referred to the number of useless 80% of the Jewish people, that is, 80% of Jews were mainly involved in trade. But Vorontsov hoped that the spacious conditions and economic potential of the Novorossiysk territory, that would be New Russian in Russian, I guess, Novorossiysk territory, he hoped that the space and potential would attract enough Jews to make coercive measures unnecessary. He also warned about probable European indignation due to the, quote, analysis, unquote, and indeed this tendency on the part of European Jewry to meddle in Russia's internal affairs did become of concern, notably with Moses Montefiore intervention described below. Now, note, Western Europe's more developed, so that there's more money, there's more banking, there's more trade, there's more industry. Russia is quite far behind, and indeed it was, that stuff was only brought to Russia basically by Germans. And so that's why you don't find Jews so much in the usury and the rest of the stuff. There just simply isn't enough industry. And that's also the reason they don't really want to necessarily get rid of all the Jews, because Jews dominate so much of the little trade that there is. Nevertheless, when you're it's actually more dangerous to go to assimilate Jews, because then they get into the institutions, they don't look different. And then you have, if you're going to fight them at that point, you have the horrible task of trying to get the Fox viewers to distinguish the Jews from the Goyim, which is, they seem to have an anti-feelers, the Goyim and the Jews, just as the Jews seem to have invisible feelers. Okay, just a couple more pages here. Like I said, this is not a super long chapter, but in order to avoid an adverse European reaction provoked by previous attempts to evict Jews from the border zone, in 1846, the Russian government publicly announced a new policy that the Jews in Poland had no nationality, no right to a movable property, and were forced to restrict their activities to petty trade and money lending, while under the ongoing transition in Russia, Jews received increasing civil and economic rights, entry into the state of Russian commercial life, commercial, real property rights, the right to join an agricultural colony, and the right to secular education, including universities and academies. Clearly, The objective was to try to lure the large Jewish population out of Poland and herd them into the vast interior, where they would not have an already surly and volatile Gentile population to subject to their predations, thus creating even more instability in Poland. And let it be made clear that the Jews did in fact receive all these rights during the first decades in the notorious, quote, prison of peoples, unquote, as Tsarist Russia came to be called. Sounds like typical Anglo-cant, doesn't it? The prison of peoples, in many cases enjoying legal status and economic benefits far superior to Gentiles. In Tsarist Russia, Jews enjoyed benefits and legal status far superior to Gentiles in Tsarist Russia. However, a century later, Jewish authors would recall a time of mass expulsions from the villages, occasionally begun but almost never completed, in parentheses, double taxation, often imposed and just as often canceled every few years. The establishment of Pale, the Pale of Settlement. We have seen that in the circumstances of the late 18th century, the boundaries of settlement were initially the Jews' geographical heritage, i.e. it's where they already were, the lands where they already lived. The 1846 decree stated, always a stranger to merger with the civil society among which they, the Jews, live, they have remained in their previous mode of existence at the expense of the labor of others, giving rise to fair complaints. For the benefit of all, there is a need to take them out of dependence on the elders of the community. The Jewish population needed education and practical knowledge to acquire which the government proposed to establish a special Jewish secondary school, provide the means for then to transition to farming, or them, I guess, an idea which successive Tsarist governments seemed unable to ever completely let go of. So they just wouldn't give up on the pipe dream of Jews becoming farmers. So like Jefferson, they kind of believed that farming is the sort of the produces the most solid people, is the most solid basis of a solid country. Also in 1846, the Jewish Sir Moses Montefiore arrived in Russia with a letter to Nicholas from Queen Victoria, his mission being, quote, to improve the plight of the Jewish people, unquote, in Russia. He toured some cities densely populated by Jews. Then from England, he sent the emperor a long letter with a proposal to release the Jews from all restrictive legislation to grant them, quote, equality with all other subjects, except, of course, the serfs, quote, and as soon as possible eliminate restrictions on the right of residence and movement within the Pale of Settlement, unquote. Merchants and craftsmen were to be allowed to travel in the interior provinces. Jews were to be allowed to hire Christians as servants and, more vitally, laborers and employees, and the Kahal was to be restored. In his response to the Montefiore Memorandum, Nicholas objected that if the conversion of the Jews to productive work were successful, this would by itself lead to the gradual reduction of constraints. There was now enhanced resistance to conscription among the Jews. Evasion became so widespread that by 1850, a new order was issued that for each called-up recruit who failed to report for duty, three would be physically seized and sent to the army. What then occurred was one of the more notorious examples in history of the Jews turning on their own kind. The three-for-one rule gave the Jewish community a vested interest to catch their own draft-dodging fugitives. They hired men called Lovchikoviki, or snatchers. Lovchikoviki. Jews hired snatchers who captured the Poimanikovi, those who were draft evaders, or simply anyone with an expired passport, even if from another province, or a teenager without a family, anyone to turn over to the recruiting sergeants in fulfillment of the quota. But all this still did not make up the shortage of recruits. In 1852, two new statutes were added. One was that for each man surrendered to the recruiters, a reward of 300 rubles would be paid in the form of relief from tax arrears, since virtually all Jews owed unpaid taxes. The second was a law, in italics here, on the suppression of the practice of hiding Jews from military service, which prescribed a series of punishments for those who fled from conscription, penalized the communities in which they were hiding, and allowed the army, instead of the missing recruits, to take the service of their family or community leaders who were responsible for the timely supply of manpower. Trying by every means to avoid conscription, many Jews fled abroad or went to other provinces. The Lovchikovics grew more active and brutal, but still even more Jews fled the draft, often hiding and living by night, and fines and arrears grew. There were innumerable protests and petitions from settled, productive part of the Jewish population. The main bone of contention was the, quote, analysis, unquote, the classification system which designated certain Jews as, quote, useful, and others as useless and therefore subject to conscription. In the early years, there were repeated attempts to get the analysis and categorization delayed, bog it down in petty bureaucratic nitpicking over terminology, Saul Alinsky style, and so on. Finally, the Tsar lost patience with the suspicious foot-dragging on the part of his officials, and he issued interim rules on the analysis of the Jews, which made it clear what criteria of wealth, occupation, and economic utility to society were to be followed. In February 1855, Nicholas I died suddenly, and his, quote, analysis was permanently stopped. So the sudden death of the emperor rescued Jews at a dangerous point in their history, as occurred a century later with Stalin's death. That ends chapter 3. So that's how Nicholas I... Joe Torre once said about one of his outfielders, I tried to make a man out of him, but he just couldn't because he was a bitch. And the Jews are a bitch. They're not going to be military conscripts, and they're not going to be farmers. They're going to be cheaters and swindlers. It's what they are. It's what they do. It's what they like. It's how they live. So, again, I've been reading to you. This is recording number 4 out of The Crucifixion of Russian, a New English translation of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, A History of the Russians and the Jews. We've been talking about Nicholas I. This was chapter 3, recording number 4. As always, at VNN Forum, Pivel.net, and KirksvilleToday.com, you can find all the material that's part of the Learning College, as I style it. And thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.